Hi. So this morning, I'm going to talk about thought and desire, and I'm going to dip in a little bit to two chapters in Wise Heart by Jack Kornfield, the chapter on storytelling mind and the chapter on desire. But this is mostly my stuff. Okay, so thoughts are by their very nature what? One-sided. Not true nor untrue. We can all agree to that, can't we? I think any rational human being can agree to that. And Jack Kornfield says, when we believe our own thoughts and opinions, we become fundamentalists. So there are all kinds of different kinds of fundamentalism, right? And it's easy to label some of the things that the Tea Party folks have been doing. They're fundamentalists. But we got to be careful, because any time we marry ourselves to a set of beliefs, whatever it is, we become fundamentalists. We become rigid. We become unable to just see clearly, just live openly, just live simply, because we've got this, in a way, our beliefs imprison us. So how do we live then, given that our thoughts are like this, neither true nor untrue? I have Steve Jobs on my mind, so I'm going to talk about Steve Jobs. And I wonder why I would have Steve Jobs on my mind. So many of you know a lot about Steve Jobs. I actually didn't know anything about Steve Jobs until he died, because I'm not a techie. But now I know stuff, just because I was interested. So I'm going to quote two or three things in my talk that he said in his commencement address at Stanford that he gave in 2005, which I thought I had just come across on online the other day, and I sent it to my kids, and they said, "Oh, Dad, that's been around for years." But it's new to me. So anyway, first thing about Steve Jobs is that he well, I don't know how much the story to tell, but he was adopted. His natural parents were very educated, and there was one criteria that they wanted the adopted parents to fit. And that was, he wanted the adoptive parents to be college graduates, because they felt education was so important. Well, the adoptive parents, it turned out, were not college graduates. They were blue collar people. They were laboring people. But they knew about this. So after he finished high school, he was a good student, and they sent him to Reed. And he spent 1 year at Reed, and then he dropped out of Reed. And he dropped out because he said, this was too expensive. I was spending all my parents' money, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just didn't feel good about spending all their money on this. And then what did he do? He hung around Reed, and he audited classes for a year and a half. He went to the Hare Krishna temple once a week to get one good meal. And then he scrounged for the rest. Some of you may remember this kind of thing if you were part of the counterculture. I don't know. Far be it from me. In the courses he said the thing about auditing courses was he got to take all the courses he really wanted to take, not the courses he was required to take. And he took a course in calligraphy, which he said was a phenomenal experience, because it taught him about different fonts, about how to present letters, how a letter should look on a page, and so here's what, and then of course, you know, he went on to found Apple. But here's what he says in his commencement address to the Stanford students, after telling them this part, right? Then he says, so you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down, and it has made all the difference in my life. So that's kind of similar to the Zen teaching, not exactly, but a little bit similar, kind of similar. What I say to people is, through meditation, it's possible to, you have to trust your meditation and trust the possibility that you can discover something that's not one-sided. That's not one-sided. And that's not a thing. And that's not a no thing. And you have to trust that you can discover that. And discovering that, and then imprinting that discovery into your being makes you ready for anything. Ready for anything. So maybe that's a little bit like what he was talking about. Maybe it's a lot like what he was talking about. I don't know. And at a talk I gave a while ago, I talked about, I guess it was down at Hokkyoji, I talked about private pilots. Private pilots have something they call seeing the elephant. And seeing the elephant happens when they're flying their planes, and all of a sudden, what they know won't help them. What they know won't help them. So, when that happens, there's a possibility to be ready. Just ready. Just in a ready state. because you trust. You don't know what you trust in. You don't know. If you know what you're trusting, you're not. That's not the elephant. That's not the elephant. So that readiness really is about what Zen practice is all about. Discovering that readiness and starting to manifest it without being very self-conscious about it. Without being at all self-conscious about it. Then we can keep our cool. Just keep our cool. Keep our equanimity. Regardless. And that's what meditation is about. It's about learning how to do that. Or should we say, unlearning, so that we can do that. And of course, at the same time in Zen, we don't diss thought. We don't diss thought. Thought's cool. Thought's wonderful. Jack Kornfield says in the chapter on thinking, when thinking about math, just think about math. Pretty simple, huh? My job outside of here, I have two jobs. One job where I sit here and I don't have to think about anything. And then another job where I have to think all day. I have to think from 8 to 5 all day. Well, that's good. I got a thinking tool. I can just use it. I don't have to wander off. And as you get more proficient at letting go, you become more able just to use your thinking tool in a very one-pointed, effective way. Because you haven't just dulled the poor thing with all this extra stuff that churns out on and on and on, over and over and over. So as thoughts are both an impediment to opening, to being available to life, to being engaged, and also they can help that, so is desire. So is desire. And but often desire casts a spell, doesn't it? Casts a spell. Very often. So I remember one of my, I don't know, I remember an adolescent spell when I fell in love with a girl. Most of you can remember that. Maybe some of you can, but I bet most of you can. And I really went into la-la land. Obsessing and thinking, driving by our house. Anybody remember that? Any of you adolescents? Any of you still adolescents? Driving by our house. Where is Tim for dinner? My dad would say. My mother would say, oh, he's out driving. Cast a spell. And there's a driven quality. Not only was I driving, I was being driven. I was being driven by the spell of desire. And when we're driven, we close down. We close down to everything else. Now, I was getting along fine with my parents. I just wasn't paying any attention to them. Completely closed down to them, right? That's what happens when we really get infatuated. In a couple of lectures ago, I talked about, I guess I've talked twice now about this friend of mine in Berkeley who was very isolated and alone after his wife left him, and he had a desire to sit. But what did he do instead of sit? Remember? Watch porn. Because he got more of immediate gratification from the porn than from the sitting. I mean, the sitting, it was just the loneliness, just the da-da-da-da-da. And then that desire, he kept satisfying it, and pretty sure soon it turned into a big spell on his life. It was just a spell. He was just really trapped by it every day, day after day. And it started very small. But we can't get rid of desire, can we? We can't get rid of it. And actually, would we want to get rid of desire? Cornfield reminds us that there would be no human beings if there weren't desire. That it's sexual desire that keeps us here. I mean, that keeps the race going. So, all right, that's significant. That's interesting. So instead of getting rid of desire, is it possible to see through the veils that create the spell? And I was talking about this the other night, but the two veils in traditional Buddhism that cast the spell are the veil of ego and the veil of the kleshas, of greed, hatred, and delusion. They reinforce each other. Ego, the veil of ego is really supported in its haziness, in its by greed, hatred, and delusion. And so they're partners in this spell casting activity and in this manifestation of the spell. So instead of getting rid of desire in Zen, what do? We have an opportunity to see through the veils, to see through those veils. They're really very thin, and they're really very transparent, but they don't seem thin. They don't seem transparent. They're really just thinner than gossamer. So when de Tocqueville came to the French philosopher de Tocqueville, whom Cornfield talks about, he came to the United States in the 1820s, and he was fascinating. And one of the things he said is, they never stop thinking of good things they have not got yet. They have not yet got. Hey, that's us, isn't it? That's Americans, isn't it? We're known for that. But for de Tocqueville, it was not just negative. It was also positive. He came from a culture where a Steve Jobs could not have... My family lives in France. They said no way could a poor boy who didn't graduate from college have done something really really successful, really innovative in France, because everything is the status quo, everything is the past, everything is tradition and bureaucracy, and so there's something wonderful about that, something wonderful about that. So yes, you know, as I said, I'm not a techie, but I live surrounded by techies, mostly in my family, actually. And two unidentified family members came over last night, and they had just bought iPhone 2s. Well, an iPhone 2, how many of you have iPhone 2s?
iPhone 4. iPad 2 or iPhone.
Is it iPhone 4?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, they just bought the latest iPhone, iPhone 4, and they came into my house and they were talking to their iPhone, and their iPhone answered. Their iPhone has a name, Siri. The iPhone 4s all have a person that you can talk with named Siri, right? Then they were looking up Siri, what's the weather like in Paris? Siri said, 59 degrees. What time it is in Paris? Siri said, then one of the smart ass people in my family said, Siri, what's my name? And Siri answered, what difference does it make? That's exactly. What? That's, Siri was a Zen teacher. You know? What difference does it make? Get over yourself. Get over yourself. Get over these veils. What difference does it make? Do you know Siri?
I don't have Siri in my life at this
time. I see. So, for us as Americans, I mean, why are we like this? Why do we never stop thinking of the good things that we don't have? Well, there's been a lot of anthropological research about this, but a suggestion is that we're an immigrant nation. We're a nation of pioneers. The past didn't help us or support us, but we can get into that, but let's not right now. That's just an example, right? Just an example. Anyway, we're not going to become desireless by doing Zen practice. I won't even say that you're going to reduce the number or amount of your desires. You might, but then maybe I should become your follower. Although I'm not good at following. I've never been good at following. So when I was a young man and doing Zen, I was trying to be so good, and I'd had some experiences of great opening, and when I was with my young partner, and she got on my case, I would just take a deep breath and wouldn't say anything. And I developed this pattern of just letting it come in, just letting it come in and pass through me. The only problem was it wasn't passing through me. So be careful about this. Be careful about this. Desire is always coming up. And if you try to be too good a Zen student, you'll start cutting off your own feelings. And so just pay attention. You don't have to do these kinds of things that the teachers, so many Vipassana teachers talk about to counterbalance that. You just notice it. Just notice. I just, at some point, this person that I was with noticed that I was being passive in the relationship. I thought I was being accepting. But she said, boy, you aren't even in this relationship anymore. You've given up. I thought I was just being a good Zen student. Whatever that is. So don't try to be a good Zen student, okay? I don't recommend it. Well, go ahead and try. Go ahead and try. See what happens. You never know. So what's healthy desire, and how do we know it? We know that being in denial is not healthy desire, right? Like I was when I was that young man at that time in my life. We know that being lost in desire, when it casts a spell on us. But that's not healthy. That's not healthy. So I'll suggest three things that are three different ways in which our desire is unhealthy. And I think it's probably healthy if it doesn't fit in any of these three categories. But I don't know. I don't know. Don't believe me. Don't believe me. Number one, is the goal of our desire, of what we're doing, to prove we're worthy. Oh, yes, worthy. We get into this religious practice and we really want to be worthy. Conquer our insecurity. Conquer others. That's the first one. The second one, are we doing the desire to cover our pain? Are we doing it to cover our pain? As my friend in Berkeley, with his porn. It was covering some real deep pain he had. Real deep pain. And he was getting immediate gratification. But then the pain would be back. So, geez. And third, does it take us away from fully living? Each second. Each millisecond. Each microsecond, if there is such a thing. Fully loving it. And so here is Steve Jobs again. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, if you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right. It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I knew I need to change something. I know I need to change something. So, healthy desire, healthy thinking, means breaking the spell, letting go of this sticky, clinging, graspy nature of desire, and carrying our desires more lightly, more lightly, more lightly, like a butterfly. Just a butterfly lighting on your shoulder. Just let it light on your shoulder. Watch it. Watch its colors. And then watch it move on. Of course, another butterfly is going to come. And then another butterfly. Hey, wow. Lightly. Lightly. Okay. If you learn nothing from Zen practice, I hope you will learn that. I hope you will learn it. But not learn it. Discover it. Be it. Be it. And Steve Jobs also says about healthy desire and healthy thought, don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. That's interesting. That's interesting. What's the own inner voice? What does that mean? We kind of think what that means. We kind of know sometimes, and then it doesn't seem like there's any inner voice. But anyway, that's what he said. Suzuki Roshi used to talk about your inmost request. He said if you really did Zazen wholeheartedly, you would begin to discover what your inmost request was. You would begin to feel your inmost request. And then it would begin to answer itself, but not an answer out there. Just a going into the request and the request turning into something alive that kept your life flowing, your inmost request. And when we're sitting, and we were sitting 40 minutes this morning, but... And everybody was, a lot of people were here sitting for 40 minutes. And that's a lot of sitting. But that's time for a lot of desires to come up. And anybody who sits for 40 minutes has a lot of desires come up. Healthy, unhealthy, in between. It's just the way it goes. And in sitting practice, it doesn't matter whether you're sitting for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes or 7-day retreat. It's uncomfortable when those desires come up. It's uncomfortable. And they may intensify. They may intensify. So my friend has trouble sleeping at night. And he says, the problem with the middle of the night, it's not that he sleeps pretty well, but he doesn't like waking up in the middle of the night, because when he wakes up in the middle of the night, then his concerns and his desires during the day are especially magnified. And then when he wakes up in the morning, he realizes that's no big deal. But in the middle of the night, it's a big deal. It's a big deal for most people when they wake up and they're not able to go to sleep, because they got nothing but those desires and the darkness in their room and their breathing. They have nothing but those. Whereas in the morning, they're fixing breakfast, they're getting dressed, they're looking at the sun. Well, sitting in meditation is much like waking up in the middle of the night. It's much like that. Now, not always, but if you sit with devotion, you will sometimes experience that. These desires are so close, and then they magnify. They magnify. So, can we graciously just accept them? Just graciously accept them. Well, if you sat for 40 minutes this morning, you did graciously accept a lot of desires. You may not felt gracious inside, but I was looking at you. I thought you were gracious. Because you just did it. You were just there with it. It's a very good practice, because you can see the desire come in, you can see it intensify, you can see it get all hot and bothered, and then you can watch it dissipate. And maybe it doesn't dissipate till the bell rings, but then when the bell rings, it dissipates. And you see that it's not you. It's not you. It has no relationship to your inmost request, to your deep heart, to your connection with all life. You see that. You see that. And that's the beginning of freeing. So becoming gracious, a gracious attitude toward our thoughts, our sticky thoughts, our messed up thoughts, our obsessive desires, our healthy desires. Healthy desires we can get obsessive about too. We can get obsessive about generosity. become very obsessed with generosity. So developing grace is what this practice is about. Developing grace. Graceful living. Graceful being. Whether we're sick or well, or up in the middle of the night, or up in the middle of the day, or besieged by a flock of butterflies. So another Steve Jobs story. Steve Jobs, excuse me. This one has been all over the media, so you guys have to know this one. You don't? That's because you don't do media during practice period, right? Well, then I'll be your media. Okay. So let's see. As we know, Steve Jobs founded Apple, and he and his partner Wozniak, something Wozniak, Steve also, okay, Steve Jobs' garage. That was his parents, his foster parents, his adopted parents' garage, not too far from where I grew up. Bay. What a deal. What a deal. No wonder I'm a Zen teacher. And then, of course, you know, Apple took off, became really internationally well-known, did really well. They did very innovative products. And then what happened? What's the next thing that happened? He got fired. Here he was, the founder of the company, and he got fired. And here's what he says. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again. Sounds like Zen, doesn't it? Less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. So, many of you have heard me talk about this before. I've talked about it several times. But probably one of the most creative periods of my life was when I also felt that I had failed big time. And the year was 1982. And I was a Zen priest here. Norm Randolph and I were kind of, when Katagiri wasn't around, we gave the talks and stuff like that. I'd been a Zen priest for a while. And I was pretty wise. Or something. Wasn't I wise, Cal?
Yes, very much so.
Thank you, honey. Thank you. And then my brother, who was 10 years younger than me, committed suicide. And I only had one brother. And I was just totally bereft, totally wiped out. He committed suicide in a locked ward in a hospital. He had serious and persistent depression and alcoholism. And I felt like my Zen practice wasn't worth horseshit, that I'd just been a fake, that I hadn't really paid attention to him, just abandoned him. I'm 10 years older than him, so he was kind of my charge. I felt he was my charge. So I almost left Zen Center at that time. Yeah, but I didn't. I just stuck around. But my zazens were hard during those years. Well, no, during those months. Actually, it wasn't months, not years. Very hard. Because talk about desire coming up. Talk about pain coming up. But at the same time that happened, that was 28 years ago that was. 28 years ago, right? Yeah, 28 years ago. The same time I began to think, I just got a sort of a seed planted in me that maybe I could do something so people who were suicidal and depressed wouldn't have to get locked up in the hospital. Maybe I could do something. And maybe I could do something so people who had serious persistent depression and had chemical dependency wouldn't get kicked out of treatment program after treatment program until they hung themselves, as my brother did. So that's what I've, other than being here, that's what I've been doing the last 28 years. It's been wonderful for me. That's why I'm 68. I don't want to retire. I'm just getting started because I see the possibility of the whole community supporting people like this, and I see it actually happening more and more, year after year. Partly, I'm lucky because it's been the last 28 years have also been a period of gradual destigmatization of depression, of mental illness in general, and a recognition of how people mask their pain with drugs and alcohol. And not wanting to diss them. So we never know, do we? We never know. when our opportunity will be here, when our opportunity just to tap into our inmost request will be here. Graciously accepting our desire, our thought, our total failure, and seeing what's there for us. There's something there for us. Something there for us. So, Steve Jobs' final piece of advice about thought and desire. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. Your own inmost urge to express your heart. So, for me, that's important, but equally important, and actually more important, is that you can, in your sitting practice, be with your thoughts and be with your desires and let them intensify and subside and intensify and subside until you settle into that no thing that makes you ready for anything. Anything. Continually ready. Continually ready. And so the Lotus Sutra says, you, the richest person in the world, have been laboring and struggling endlessly, not understanding that you already possess all that you seek. So just trusting the elephant. That's all this is about, trusting the elephant. Okay, so I think that's all I need to say for today. Would you guys like to ask a question or say something or tell an elephant story? Pardon? Pardon?
Did Speed have a public funeral? I didn't read anything about that. I wondered, did they freeze his body?
I have no idea.
Does anybody looked up on his deal and said his religion was Buddhist, but I don't know.
He was a non-practicing Buddhist.
Yeah, he's kind of the son of bitch to work for.
Yes, that's what I heard. That's what I heard. What else, you guys? Anything else? Yeah.
Was it Hokioji for that Dharma talk? Could you talk more about the elephant? What that means?
Oh, well, the thing about this is what I've read about it. I've never flown a private plane. But the thing about learning, I've never flown at all. But what I read about it is that private pilots, unlike commercial pilots, always face the possibility that their flight plans will not match what's going on, and that their knowledge of how to control their flight plans and adjust them will not match anything. And sometimes they just have to let go of all of it and just pay attention to their senses. And they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know what's going to happen. And sometimes they do fine, and sometimes they die. Sometimes they freeze up. Sometimes they get panicky, and I don't think there are any data on whether they're more likely to live if they welcome the elephant, but it would make sense that they would be more likely to live if they trusted the elephant, because then they could trust their senses. But even then they might die. But that's just what life is about. So that's the.
I've heard that about doctors too.
Oh, doctors?
Treating a patient in an emergency situation where letting go of your training is the best thing that you can do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, actually, the actuarial tables show that, scuba diving and riding in a private plane are the two most dangerous things you can do. So, at least from an actuary, you know, from that point of view. What else? The innermost request? Well, this is hard for me to talk about. We do have some urges to do things in this world that are deep, and they're usually covered up by our storyline and all this garbage with all our desires and stuff. We have some deep urges to manifest something we care about, and in sitting, we sometimes can get in touch with that. And sitting's not the only way to get in touch with it, but stillness is required to get in touch with that stillness. And of course, if you look for it, you don't necessarily find it. But you know, our lives are short. There are things that we really desire, each of us, to. And I mean desire in a, you know, not this, in a very deep sense. It's related to the bodhisattva path, really. But if you start thinking about being there for others, that messes it up. So, I don't know what more to say about that. Do you have something to say about it, Pamela?
I am wondering about, it seems like what you're talking about is something deeper than trusting your gut or exciting your voice. It sounds like it's something else other than that. So,
trusting your gut has become a cliche, you know, and trusting your inner voice, it become cliches, and then we try to imitate them. This is something that just comes out of great stillness and feeling of interconnection. You know, I don't know what more to say about it.
I was curious about what you said about your brother's death.
Yeah.
You transformed his death into a desire to help other people in similar situations. But I imagine you also went through a personal journey thinking about your failure to a certain extent for your brother.
My what?
Yeah, that you described that you felt like you let him down.
Yeah. Yep.
And I'm wondering when somebody faces a situation like that, when you continue to look at the depths of what happened and your participation in it, and when do you move on?
And when you what?
And when do you move on?
Well, you know, this is going to sound like a cliche, but I'm a Zen teacher. Sit, meditation, meditation, meditation. You don't know. But you have to allow yourself quiet time to grieve, and you can't grieve when you're being boisterous or when you're involved in your storylines too much. Quiet time, and then you see what happens. You see what quiet time is very more nurturing than any people, I think, the people generally realize. So I'm saying Zazen, but I'm also saying, geez, if you could just sit by the lake for 10 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day at a time of day the joggers aren't going by or something. That's all I know because that's my experience, and I think there needs to be a clearing out. And then when there's a clearing out of the voice, which was in my case not the inner voice but kind of, you asshole, that was the voice, Tim, you asshole. Just seeing that voice and then allowing that voice to come up, to dissipate, to go away, and then not till I couldn't even grieve till I let go of that, you know. And then out of that, beginning to say, oh, maybe something I can do here. Maybe something I can do. But I had no idea what it was. No idea. And so for over the last 28 years, my life, other than here, has been spent developing programs for people in mental health crisis, where they don't get locked up. There are no locks. And to helping people with serious and persistent depression deal with their chemical use without dissing them if they fall away and make a mistake, but I didn't know, so it just happened. So I think in each case, allow your, you need space in your life. You need internal space. I don't care whether you do zazen. I don't care whether you do retreat. You need internal space. You're too fast, all of you. You're too fast. And then your life's gone. It's gone. So you need quietness. You need space. And then your inmost request will come out. It'll flower in your life. And it's not a big deal. Maybe it's just a little dandelion. That's cool. That's cool. You don't need anything more than a little dandelion. This sounds dramatic in most requests. Just a little dandelion comes up, sprouts there in your grief. And you water that little dandelion. You sing to that little dandelion. You put that little dandelion under behind your ear, and then that dandelion blows away. How is that? Oh, all right. Yeah.
You did bring Steve Jobs up, and he did focus on doing things in a certain way.
Yep.
His confidence returned.
Yep.
And, he mentioned the Zen characteristics of some of these things. It's also been written that he didn't pay much attention to others.
Yes, that's been written.
Personal relationships, whether they were family or
that's been written.
Or, friends or employees.
Yes.
So, how do you reconcile that? How do you balance that? How do you balance on an individual?
Well, I would say, from a Zen point of view, he was out of balance. He was out of balance. But sometimes, being out of balance, you do great things. But if I were a Zen teacher, I would have said, he didn't come to me, I would have worked with him. I would say, you got to work on, you made a commitment to this woman, honey. Come on. Slow down a little bit. But if I'd done that, he might not have accomplished all he'd done. How important is his accomplishment? I don't know. What will posterity think about it? How does it really relate to the heart? How does all this techie stuff relate to the heart? The iPhone 4, the iPhone 84. Gee, when the iPhone 10, what will that be like? Somebody, they'll be talking back to us and giving us a lot of shit, I guess. Won't they? Last night they told my son, well, what difference does it make that they don't know his name? Imagine that rude woman. I'm not suggesting we emulate him at all. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I'm not here to judge him either. And he did some cool things, and he had some wonderful insights. And another aspect of his Zen was that he treasured beauty. He loved beauty. He wanted to do something really beautiful. He didn't care what it was. It was just a little tiny mouse. It was the most beautiful, and he believed that the most beautiful way of doing something was also the simplest way. That if you could do it the simplest way, the most user-friendly way, it would be the most beautiful. And so for my techie friends, this is incredible. Pardon?
Saying no to the 1,000 things. That was his thing.
Oh, that his thing?
Yeah, saying no to the 1,000 things.
I see. Okay. Sounds like Zen too, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, I feel it when you know someone that's really, really depressed, and I am saying that you're talking about a depression man, that it's really helpful just to listen.
It's really what?
To listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you're a good listener, and somebody has a lot of problems, they'll put them out there, and that helps.
Yep. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yep. And the problem with people who mask their depression with drugs and alcohol is that you don't get they're depressed. and you think they're just being, they're just acting out, and they should just sober up. And that's naive. We were all naive then. Well, not that we're not naive now. We're naive about something else now, right? That's a good point. Thank you. Okay. Everybody cool or not? All right.